Thank you. It's a real pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for coming. I don't know how much you know about this book, but basically it's about six people, all very different, all of them in different ways, immigrants or descendants of immigrants. Two of them are illegal and three are legal. And I'm just going to read you, apparently for 15 minutes, two or three extracts so you can get some sort of idea of what's going on. It's quite a sort of complicated story. It is a detective story. So perhaps I will start off just with the preface for that, which is called Uneasy City. At night, even in these dead months of the year, the city is never wholly dark. Its shadows twitch with a harsh orange light that glows and fades, fades and glows, as a pulse of electric power courses through its body like dreams. The sour air breathed in and out by 8 million lungs, stained by exhaust pipes and strained through ventilators, is never clean, although after a time you no longer notice its bitter taste and smell. The dust of ages swirls and falls, staining walls, darkening glass, coating surfaces, clogging lungs. Bricks, leaves, paper, food, bones, and skin all decay, reduced to an almost invisible specks that accumulate into the eternal dust of London. The only times the city can breathe freely is when a wind blows in from a far-off place, bringing with it gulls and the cries of the sea, or the fresh, sweet air from the west. But this city is a world of its own, a country within a country. People are used to taking the old and making it new, and used too to taking the new and making it old. Every glass of water from its taps, it is said, has passed six times through the kidneys of another, and every scrap of its land has been trodden on, fought over, dug up, and broken down for centuries. Yet fresh water wells up too from under roads and buildings, so that the buried landscape beneath is never quite forgotten. This place could almost be countryside, for here its streams fall into ponds rather than hidden pipes or channels. It is here that the murderer has come to hide the body. The woman is a great deal heavier than he had expected. Perhaps he's been stupid not to put the body in the boot of the car and dump it far away. Only he knows how easily the police can find out the number plates of passing vehicles in the vicinity of a murder. Sticking to well-known routes that he always takes is wiser. This side of the heath has few CCTV cameras, and he's waited a long time in the side road for people to leave. Not that many are around on a winter's night, with the wind shrilling in the bare branches like distant alarms. He's satisfied with his choice. All the same, dragging the grey mailbag out of the back seat and onto the grassy bank is almost too much for one person. He should have kept her semi-conscious instead of strangling her when he had the opportunity. It had been so quick and easy, like killing a chicken, and of course quite silent. He knows just where he wants to put the bag. There's an area by the ponds, a nature reserve fenced off from people and dogs, but not from the wilder inhabitants like foxes, where a body could lie and rot for years without ever being discovered. The place stinks already, being clogged with mud and mire. Nobody will notice a little extra smell. The plan had been made more or less on the spur of the moment, but it seems a good one to him, though he's still worried about whether she's tricked him. No time to check yet. The man grunts and lurches, hating her even more than in life, and his hatred gives him strength, so that when he gives a final heave over the railings, the body flies through the air and lands with a splash. For a moment, it seems as if it won't work. He watches anxiously, all the time alert for any other people, while the bag seems to waver as if uncertain. Then to his relief, it sinks down, making a plopping noise that is almost comical as the air inside escapes. Something moves on the bank and he freezes. But it's only a water bird, labouring along the edges, alarmed by the disturbance. Finally, the bag disappears from sight, leaving the water of the pond undisturbed, but for the skeletal forms of bare trees and shrubs, which occasionally draw their twigs across its depths, like long, bony fingers. and sigh. The woman had survived many trials long before the one that had taken her life. She'd been young and strong and attractive. She had possessed a good brain, which had enabled her to learn a new language, a language that was itself a fusion of many other tongues, and which she believed would bring her miraculously to a better future. She'd been like so many Londoners, a person who did not fit in anywhere else, and who'd come to the city hoping to find a new beginning. Now, there, she is just one more discarded thing, which will be counted as lost, if she is counted at all. So, that is the murder that starts the story off. This is the woman who, I don't think it spoils the story to know, is deeply connected with the victim. She's called Polly. She appears in a previous book of mine called Love in Idleness as a very different character. She's there, a kind of surrendered mother and wife. She's now divorced and she's working again. And she's working as a human rights lawyer. Even in sleep, Polly is conscious of guilt. Like a splinter forcing its way to the surface of her skin, it throbs just below the level of consciousness until she wakes. Drowsily, she listens to the occasional rattle of the sash window in its frame and the creak of floorboards until the pressure in her bladder forces her up. Walking with the cautious, shuffling tread of one who knows the floor is mined with Warhammer figurines, she gropes her way to the bathroom. The central heating is off and the blind up, showing her the upper half of a wide, tree-lined street in the dim orange streetlight. Two rows of seemingly identical, flat-fronted, white-stuccoed early Victorian houses face each other, each subtly different, like Darwin's finches on the Galapagos Islands. Polly, with her potted olive tree, farrow and ball paintwork, and smeg fridge, is a relatively recent arrival, for half the street is gentrified and half still owned by the council. She feels at ease here on the scruffy edge of Islington and Camden Town, something she'd never felt during her marriage in Fulham. She chose it because it's close to where she grew up and also to where she now works as a solicitor in a firm specialising in human rights cases. Although the house bought following her divorce is comfortable and pretty and her children go to private schools, she earns a modest salary, having taken almost a decade out of full-time employment when her children were young. Theo, her ex-husband, is a very different kind of lawyer. He works in the city and hates London. This town has had it good for a decade, but now the party's over, he likes to say. Its infrastructure, transport system, education, policing and security all suck. I'm telling you, Polly, people are talking seriously about relocating to Geneva. By people, Theo always means those like himself, who earn a minimum of £1 million a year. The rest do not exist. Polly, there, is obdurate. Vague presentiments of danger have been a part of every Londoner's life for the past 5 years, but Theo's alarmism is ludicrous. He sees threats everywhere and couldn't understand why nobody else had even bothered to buy duct tape after 9/11. Dad's weird about people, isn't he? Robbie had remarked after a weekend away with his father. He thinks people wear towels on their heads to blow up planes. The thing about Daddy's country is they didn't live through two world wars and the IRA bombs, Polly told him. They're paranoid about the rest of the world. Theo had been amazed to discover just how deeply Americans were now hated by the British. He returns this hatred with interest. He wants to take Tanya and Robbie back to the States to whisk them into the kind of sprawling suburban New England home which his colleagues live in, complete with Mexican maids and a swimming pool. Theo, that simply isn't the way British people live, Polly had said. She has window locks and a London bar on her doors, but refuses to have a burglar alarm, though Theo has insisted she have a panic button installed. You're a woman living with my children, and I have the right to insist they have some protection, he'd said. Burglars can't break in, Polly had told him. We're very safe here. The windows are all toughened glass. And besides, this is a friendly house, can't you feel? Theo had looked at her as if she was an idiot, and perhaps it is silly of her to believe this, but Polly doesn't care. She's free, and this house belongs to her. Polly thinks gratefully of Irina overhead. Bill, her lover, has teased her about the way her life is dependent on cheap foreign labour, and she's conscious of the irony that while her professional life often consists of helping refugees and illegal immigrants, her ability to do so depends upon exploiting them. Is it for this that Shakespeare penned his immortal plays, Smith developed his economic theories, and Berners-Lee invented the internet, so that your strawberries can be picked by Eastern Europeans, your streets swept by Serbs, your laundry ironed by Pakistanis, and your garden manicured by an Italian? Bill says. Yes. But by far the most important is Irina, who works 25 hours a week for £70, not counting babysitting or the school holidays. Irina does the housework, collects Robbie from school, cooks the children their tea, makes sure they do their homework, and in short, performs all the boring chores of being a housewife and mother that Polly has dropped because of her job. She loves her children, yet she can't deny that when she goes back to work on a Monday morning, she's always relieved to leave them behind until 8 p.m. "This is my rock, Irina," is how Polly introduces her. Or else, "This is Irina, my right hand." It's only a minor worry that being Russian, she happens to be illegal. I don't know if I've got time for one more totally different world. Right. This is a little bit about, in a way, one of the people who's really the hero of the book. This is a Zimbabwean refugee called Job. And Job has two jobs. He works in a minicab firm, and he works at a car wash place called the AA Car Wash. And that's a little bit that I'm going to read to you about now. Right. "Since Job arrived in the UK, vast areas of wasteland in North London have been lifted up, turned over, pounded down, and built upon in preparation for the Eurotunnel station at St Pancras and the new high-speed rail connection to Europe. Already an area that was largely frequented by prostitutes and drug dealers has become less steeped in vice, though when he drives through late at night, he can still see streetwalkers negotiating with men and couples in steamed-up cars. By day, however, it's becoming ever more slick as money works its magic. Blocks of apartments have been constructed along the canal, trees have been planted, and almost every month it seems as if something new is happening. The AA car wash is squeezed into an obscure corner of this unceasing ferment. It is a tenebrous, echoing space of blank, blackened bricks and dripping pipes, with a semicircular drive of pocked and spotted concrete so that cars can come in from the north and go out again to the south to the city centre. Rainwater collects in puddles where the concrete has been patched with tarmac, and crusts of darkness scab the walls behind loops of black electric cable, left hanging for an unknown purpose. Everything at the AA car wash is sunk in age and decrepitude, apart from its staff, who are young. The oldest person there is probably Job himself, and he's only 22. There are no mechanical brushes here, only buckets and sponges and vacuum cleaners wielded by men in overalls the colour of wet ashes. It was a mystery at first to Job why anyone should prefer human beings rather than the drama of big whirling blue brushes that descend and ascend mechanically onto a car. Yet not only are people better cleaners, they are cheaper. They cost less than a machine, for they earn £2 an hour performing the same repetitive motions until they get deported, get sick, or move on. Like Job, the other washers had arrived in the UK as students, and many genuinely want to study. They soon found, however, they couldn't afford the fees. The two are supporting younger brothers through college in the hope that at least one family member may make a better life here. Job, who has no such family ties, both pities them for their responsibilities and envies their closeness to their families. He is naturally friendly, and his loneliness aches like a wound. It's 2 years since he's felt a woman's skin next to his, and there are times when he misses Manisha so much that it feels like a part of him has been cut off, that she's beside him like his phantom, itching and hurting. But the only woman he sees each day is the boss's straw-haired daughter, Jane, who sits watching a small TV set, painting her nails with the St. George cross, when not handing out coloured tickets. Jane never speaks to the men at the AA car wash, who are beneath her consciousness, but she smiles and flirts with the drivers if they arrive in an expensive car. The seven washers are used to being ignored, and she does not bother to learn their names. They know each other's names, however, and on days when the wind is less chill and a little sun comes out, they sit during quiet times with their backs against the wall, smoking and talking softly. All are from different parts of Africa, and all have become friendly enough once it has been established that none of them is Nigerian. "Those low, dishonest people, they're all liars and thieves," says Michael. He is a refugee from Eritrea, whose other job is delivering laundry all over North London. "I do not like them," says John the Ghanaian. "We are not Nigerians, thank God." "If I were Nigerian, I would feel shame," says Sebastian, the Rwandan. "Nigerians feel no shame, my brother. That is why they are Nigerians," says Michael. "And traffic wardens," says Job, and they laugh, for traffic wardens are a common enemy, even if you will never have a car. To be a traffic warden in London is to be the lowest order of humanity, hated by all but other traffic wardens, and it is no surprise to find that, with pleasing logic, most traffic wardens are Nigerian. Only Job understands why they really hate Nigerians. They are wealthier than other Africans because they have oil. "If my country had oil like Nigeria, we would not have Mugabe," Job says. But Michael shakes his head. "If your country had oil, then you would have American soldiers instead of African ones." Right, that's a little bit about Job. And I just wanted to give you a tiny bit. I don't know if I've got time. Again, this is another very different world. All these characters meet. They all affect each other's lives tremendously. But this is still from quite close to the beginning. This is, in a way, the most privileged member of the cast. She's someone who is a kind of Cinderella figure. She's been engaged to a very, very rich American, and she's broken off the engagement. But and she's come to London, as a great many posh American girls seem to do, and she's come to work on a weekly political magazine, which is not based on The Spectator, for an appalling editor who's not Boris Johnson. And this is a little bit about him. The Rambler magazine is housed in a tall terrace building in need of repair. Bought from the bankrupted estate of the disgraced media magnate Max de Monde over a decade ago, its alcoholic but aristocratic editor had survived for another 5 years before being fired to make way for Quentin Breeden. He is, according to gossip, the only member of staff to be paid properly, though his columns for the Daily Chronicle also net him a small fortune, and his distinctive appearances on TV quiz shows have made him a minor celebrity. There are even rumours that he may one day go into politics, that he's too maverick a figure to have come out in favour of any party to date. The magazine itself is severely underfunded by its proprietor, Roger Trench. He keeps a luxurious flat at the top of the building for company whom his wife refuses to entertain, but the rest of the structure seems not to have changed since the 1930s. Its radiators, painted the colour of gravy, are barely functioning. Its computers are riddled with viruses. Its toilets clank, and all its staff are in Debrett's peerage. Quentin had explained to Katie, in the days when he still spoke to her, how matters were arranged. "The fact is, we pay £100 for an article, which means writers only write for us at the beginning of their careers when they're desperate, or at the end when it no longer matters. So everyone here, from the advertising manager to the secretary, has a private income. I pick up the kind of talent that comes through knowing the right people. So it's all nepotism. Not entirely. The Rambler, you see, positions itself as the unofficial opposition to whichever government is in power. It's a British institution. People go on to great things from here. Katie goes up the steps to the scarred front door, which is, if anything, in even worse condition than that of her flat. Over it is a fanlight shaped like a collapsed umbrella, and to one side, behind an iron boot scraper, huddle 6 bottles of skimmed milk, veined like marble because nobody but herself ever brings it into the office. There is also, she sees with a sinking heart, a small bearded man in glasses and a long striped scarf hovering. Katie recognises him. It is Eric Claude, the persistent poet. He haunts a number of magazines, seemingly on a rota, and is almost certainly mad. Hi, more submissions? He thrusts a brown padded envelope into her hands. I'll see that the editor gets it, she says kindly. Inside, the narrow hall is crowded. Every tread of the rickety, uncarpeted stairs has padded envelopes, books, sheaves of paper piled on it, deposited by books and arts on the ground floor. With a movement of agility remarkable in one so rotund, the little man slips past her. Katie, Quentin bellows, where have you been? He emerges from his office on the first floor, glaring down at them. Then slowly, he raises his arm and points accusingly at the figure beside her. Is that a poet? Mesmerized, Katie and the little man nod. Quentin swells with awful fury. Out! Out! Get out! If you just, people say... Quentin seizes a stick from the umbrella stand by his door and descends, making elegant fencing motions. We do not publish poetry. The poet, with a terrified squeal, bolts. Restored to humour, Quentin says, worse than rats. If you ever let another poet in, Katie, you're fired.